3D printing today, show number 553, BVOH, viscous lithography. Autodesk can dump your Fusion 360 files.
Welcome back to 3D Printing Today, the podcast about all aspects of 3D printing. Hobby, professional, industrial, it doesn't matter what kind of 3D printing, we cover it all. My name's Andy Cohen, I'm here with Mr. Whitney Potter.
How are you doing, Andy?
I'm doing pretty good. So our news story today actually came out in the trades right before Thanksgiving, and it's about a company called Kimya that has publicly stated that it's withdrawing from the 3D printing filament market. Now, this is notable because Kimya specialized in the higher performance, real serious filament, such as PEKK and
polycarbonate,
polycarbonates and PEEK, the stuff that needs real heat soaking and really high temps at the nozzle.
But produces industrial quality parts if it's printed properly.
Right. And as I've stated in this podcast before, in my previous lives, in one job I had, we used PEEK to produce a part that had extremely high tight tolerances and had to be extremely rigid and strong. We would get the part. I'm pretty sure it was molded. I don't think we 3D printed it at that time because it was a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And then after we got the part in, we would machine the part to the tight tolerances.
Right. This is like an aerospace.
It was DOD aerospace stuff.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. PEEK and PEKK are, and I think they're also referred to as Ultem. There's a commercial name for one of those.
Ultem is one of those, PEKK or PEEK. I can't remember which one, but yeah, we sometimes see it as a thin film used for build plate coating.
Yeah,
that's one of your engineering grade plastics.
In years past, we've seen companies make the thermal tube out of PEKK or PEEK. I've seen it a couple times.
Yeah, some of the early, like the Budish nozzle had a PEEK. The whole hot end was made out of PEEK, basically.
Yeah, these are very high performance materials, and the fact that Kimya is pulling out of the market is indicative of a lack of sales and a lack of use of these materials in the 3D printing world.
Right.
And one can argue, well, that's because the 3D printers themselves are extremely expensive. They're not at the hobby level. They're at the professional level.
And the material's extremely expensive.
The material itself, it's really challenging to produce it. We have zero experience 3D printing this stuff, so we don't know how tricky it is.
And the thing that we tend to forget kind of at the consumer end of things is that it's relatively easy to produce filament. It's very hard to produce polymers. So producing the raw feedstock to make filaments that's the real hard thing.
Yeah.
And stuff like PETG and PLA, the stuff that we're ABS, the stuff that we're used to, those are all commodity polymers that are being produced on a very large scale. So it's not hard to get the raw material. And then, I mean, there's certainly a lot of work that goes into extruding really good, high quality, high tolerance filament, as we've discovered. But there's a lot of people who've over the years figured out how to do that. Making the polymers is a whole nother ball of wax. And that's sort of where the split is here, that you can easily make commodity filaments, but the fancy stuff, that's going to be tricky. It takes a really big company with a lot of resources to do that.
Yeah, and the article,
and it's expensive.
The article points to BASF also leaving the market, and that's a bellwether sign right there.
Yep.
So
BASF had a metal infused filament that you could buy. You would buy the filament, do your prints, and then send them in to have them post processed. It's like a stainless steel.
Yeah, I remember
filament.
That. Yeah.
So yeah, there's all kinds of stuff you can do if you're a big chemical company, but you've also got to make money doing it, and I don't think they did.
Yeah, so it doesn't bode well for 3D printing these materials in the near future, because this material is expensive to begin with. Now, with having less people producing it, means it's going to be even more expensive. So for those companies that are making printers in this market, it's going to be challenging. They're up against some heavy headwinds.
Well, luckily those printers all print other materials as well. It's just that the ability to print the engineering grade stuff was a selling point.
Yeah. In the meantime, what's coming up on our show this week, Whitney?
Well, let's see. We're going to start out talking about BVOH.
Which is?
It's a new soluble, not even really a new one, but it's a soluble filament that's around, I think.
And then we're going to talk about viscous lithography.
And then you're going to tell us about how Autodesk can dump your Fusion 360 files.
Ouch. Oh, boy.
So, longtime listener and frequent contributor Ted Wout brought this to our attention.
Oh, cool.
You have a new choice of a water-soluble support material for those who are interested in working with that. We're used to PVA as being sort of the water-soluble support material, and for a long time it was the only one. Now there's a new one called BVOH. Otherwise known as butenediol vinyl alcohol copolymer. So you can hear the vinyl alcohol in there. That's the VA of polyvinyl alcohol. So it is kind of a cousin of PVA, but it has some improved properties in terms of how we use it for printing. It's still moisture sensitive like PVA is, but it sticks to just about any of the materials we would want to use it with, which the original plain PVA does not. So if you're printing like nylon or ABS, I think were problems with PVA, and BVOH will print with them. So anyway, if soluble support is something that you do, also it dissolves more quickly and more readily than PVA. So if soluble support is something that you are interested in trying, or something that you use in your printing process for whatever, there's a new kid in town. Now it's interesting that it is the price is highly variable depending on where you get it from. The best price I could find was Matter Hackers is selling BASF's product, and BASF is a huge, European industrial company, so that's going to be a high quality material. And they're $50 for a, how big a spool is that? That's like a, I think it's a third of a kilo. It's a 0.35 kilos. So for $50, which is for soluble support material, that's pretty much, that's not a bad price. There's other companies that are selling it into the many hundreds of dollars.
Well, if you go on Amazon, that's PVA. Hold on. So Verbatim sells BVOH.
Yeah.
500 gram reel for $88.
Yeah. Verbatim is another big chemical manufacturer. It's funny, BASF and Verbatim both used to be audio tape manufacturers.
Yeah. Let's see. All the others are PVA that I'm seeing on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
There is another one from Verbatim that's 500 grams.
Mm-hmm.
It's 2.85 millimeters. What's that other one? Oh, that other one's 1.75. So
yeah.
Here's the one at 2.85 millimeters. It's $154. I guess, it's a thicker filament, so there's more material. That doesn't make sense.
No, so 500 grams. By the weight, yeah. So
that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, no, there's a high variability in pricing. For instance, there's another company that's selling it, and I don't know what the application is for this. I'm assuming there's got to be some industrial machine or something that is capable of using this, because it's available in very large spools. Like you can get a 4.5 kilogram spool of it from one supplier. And it's all the 3 mil, like the big fat stuff, which I didn't know anybody used anymore. The 4.5 kilos of it is $891. that's almost $200 a kilo, which I'm not sure why you'd want to pay that much for it. But anyways, it's a new product that you can try out.
So why would you need it? Well, full contact support with PLA versus PETG, that will work only as long as you can get the filament out.
Right, as long as the geometry is such that the support materials can be physically removed.
Right, otherwise
and some applications they cannot.
Right, so there are applications in which that's the case, in which case a dissolvable material such as PVA or this stuff is what you'd have to use. If you don't want to go with PETG or PLA, well, if you're going with ABS, there's a couple of solutions that you can go beyond PVA and BVOH. You can use HIPS and melt it away with
high-impact polystyrene. You
know, limonene, yeah. I think it is.
Yeah, it's basically like your Citrosolve stuff, but it's a nasty process. Yeah.
I wouldn't go there. I wouldn't recommend it.
There's something to be said for water-soluble.
Yeah, so what if you're printing in, you know, PA66 nylons,
yep.
Or if you're in, most importantly, GPU.
Mm-hmm.
GPU breakaway support's real problematic.
Yep,
it sticks.
Yep.
So yeah,
supposedly BVOH works with nylons and TPU. So
there you go. That's its use case.
Yep. So we don't hear a lot about BCN 3D. It's a Spanish 3D printing company that their sort of claim to fame, I think, is they were the first producers, commercial producers of an IDEX machine.
That's right.
But they make super high quality, mostly IDEX machines now, but super high quality, fully enclosed kind of industrial printers. They've come up with another really interesting idea. This is in the resin printing space. That's called viscous lithography manufacturing, VLM. Relatively new technology from them. A couple of years ago, they came out with it, and it is a really slick system. That basically, what it does is, rather than we're used to sort of printing upside down with our SLA machine, right?
Right.
So the print is produced upside down, and you're sort of dipping the print in a vat of resin. Then through the clear window on the underside of the resin, you're shining a light source or a laser that cures the resin, and then building up layers like that. Well, they are building up their layers with a right side up build plate. Okay. Mm. And they have their resin has to be have a certain amount of viscosity, because basically they've got a belt that goes across the top of the build plate or the build area, and it looks like a FEP type material. It's some transparent plastic, and it basically goes through a little screed that squeegees a very thin layer of resin onto it that hangs onto the underside of it.
And then that kind of touches the top of the print.
Then you're basically printing from the bottom up rather than, you know, upside down.
Well, that's a good idea.
So you still have the same support issues. I mean, just like, you know, just because we're printing, you know, upside down,
you still get floaters.
You still have support issues. Yeah. That doesn't really matter. But what is slick about it now, and I don't know if they're actually doing this or if this was just kind of an idea that we could. I haven't seen any actual prints of this, but they have a really slick thing on their website that shows that basically as they're building up their part, they're bringing, you know, the resin out over it and then sticking it on, curing it from above with a, I think they're using a an LCD UV LCD array, mm-hmm. And then recoating and doing it again. But they can roll that top layer in the opposite direction, and they can have a vat of material on the other side, and so they can have basically, essentially, an IDEX or a two materials on an SLA printer.
Fascinating.
Which is pretty cool.
That is a fascinating approach because they don't blend, they don't mix.
Right.
Wow.
So you could do multiple colors. You could do a support material, like a full contact support or a soluble support material. So lots of interesting possibilities of having essentially a multi-material SLA printer.
This company has always been a very, very innovative company. They've always gone against the grain and done things that other people never bothered with. I'm not sure. Is this the company that did the needle valves on the extruders?
I don't recall.
But they've been around for a long time now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're headquartered in Barcelona in Spain.
Nice place to be. I love that
town. Yeah.
Wow. Really interesting. Check it out.
Yeah. And it also allows, to use a whole different range of materials materials you can't use if the resin has to be very thin and fluid.
Yeah. They were the first FDM IDEX machine.
Yes.
And they still sell them. I'm looking at the Epsilon right now, and I think Matterhackers has them and sells them. Really interesting company. Interesting stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very high quality machines.
So. Yeah. Thanks. Got to give credit where credit's due.
Uh-oh.
This is another thing we got from our friend Kurt.
Okay.
VRFX. Uh-huh. Kurt posted on our forum about an interesting article that came out. Let's see if I can find the reference to that article. It's going to be in our show notes. It comes from ZDNet, of all places. And it's a very interesting article, something that we should all keep in mind if we use Fusion 360. The article states that if you do not load and open Fusion 360, assuming your free account, if your free hobby account, and you don't open it at least once a year, they dump it along with all your files.
Okay. Without giving you any notice of this.
I didn't see any indication that they do warn you.
I would be surprised if they would do it without warning you. Now, of course, that means that you have to be accessing whatever email account they have for you. And you have to be reading everything that comes in. And I know I get all kinds of garbage coming in on my email accounts. So,
well, the other issue is that this is, according to the article, a new limitation that they just did.
Okay.
So if there's a warning, we won't know for at least 11 months or so.
Right.
Because I think this article came out September 9th. This segment will probably come out within a month or so.
Yeah.
After we've recorded it. So it's going to come out late in the fall.
Sure.
So if you're a Fusion 360 user.
A very sporadic Fusion 360 user in that you haven't accessed your account for a year.
And it's a free account.
Right.
You should pay attention to this.
Well, yeah, no, it's good to be aware of, but I can understand why they're doing that. I think it makes sense for them to give people notice of that. And you get notices periodically from like photo sharing sites and stuff that I get. If you don't, I'm forgetting the name, but the one where you print photo books and stuff.
Yeah.
And they're like, hey, if you don't access your account, don't even log into your account for, a year or whatever, we're gonna dump it. I'm like, yeah, well, why wouldn't they? I mean, because they're there to make money. And if you are, they're providing a free service for you, but if all you're using is the free service, that's not a business model for them. And I mean, Autodesk, I understand that they have a, a very self-serving interest in giving us all free accounts, that they're trying to get us hooked.
and they do get you hooked.
Right.
They get you hooked.
It's a great product.
They get you hooked by you learning to use the software.
Right.
A kind of software which has a fairly steep learning curve mm-hmm. compared to others,
mm-hmm.
and one which once you're in it and you've learned to think that way.
Right, you'd be loath to change platforms.
You don't want to.
Yeah.
And their price compared to their biggest competitors uh-huh. is quite a bargain compared to their competitors. So,
right, so I understand why they're doing that, but on the other hand, I understand why they don't want to be maintaining thousands of accounts for somebody who logged in and, you know, just checked it out once and then hasn't touched it for a year. That totally makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, if you're not going in there at least once a month, and that's once a month for me, that's a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in there at least two or three times a week.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're in there once a month, I would say that your depth of knowledge will fade,
mm-hmm, sure.
and you have to relearn certain obscure things that you don't use very often.
Right, and on top of that, they update things and change the way things work periodically.
That's exactly right. In the article, which is a great article, highly recommend checking it out, they give you a couple of options to do. One is to remind yourself every 11 months or so to log in to Fusion 360. I don't think that's a good option.
Yeah, I would say if that's as little as you're actually using it, if there's anything on there that's actually of value to you, download it, make a backup of it, export it as an STL if that's appropriate for it, so you have a copy of it, and just let it go because you're not using it.
Well, that would be option two.
Uh-huh.
But option two, the way the article describes it, is not to save it as a mesh STL.
Uh-huh.
But to save it as a F3D file.
Right, yeah. You can do that, but I'm saying for at least most of the things that I do on Fusion 360 are ultimately going to be printables, right? They're ultimately going to be something that I'm going to output as a mesh and then 3D print it. And so save copies of those. Now, I don't. There's a lot of stuff that I print. It's kind of a one-off. I need one of these for a project. Says print it. Okay, and we've got it, you know. But then I don't bother to save the file somewhere. I have it in my Fusion 360 as a non-editable file somewhere in an archive there. But if I were going to lose access to that account, you know, you go through and see which one of those you want. Yeah, ideally you would have the editable version of it. But the thing is, the editable version of it, you can't do anything with except re-upload it to Fusion 360. So if you lose access to it, or if you have to pay for access to it at some point in the future, you'd be kind of stuck there.
Yeah.
So so saving the mesh version of it, which is the ultimate deliverable that at least that I want out of it, is probably makes more sense.
Well, in my opinion,
mm-hmm.
what makes more sense, at least for me,
uh-huh.
is, you know, every time I make something, I mm-hmm. make a folder for it or a directory,
uh-huh.
name it in a way that I'll be able to find it.
Yeah.
And all files associated with it, I drop in there, including versions of the STL, I version them.
Yeah.
But what I have not been doing is exporting the Fusion 360 file as a Fusion 360 uh-huh. file into those directories. Now I will.
Yeah, sure.
From now on.
It makes sense. Sure.
Yeah. So I have to go through, and I'm going to do this. I'm going to go into my Fusion 360 folders, which are in the cloud, of which I've got, geez, they don't tell you how many you got, but I got folders within folders of
well, sure.
lots of design, years worth of designs.
Oh, yeah, I've designed hundreds of things.
And it's going to take me a long time.
Yeah, but how many of them have any long-term use?
Doesn't matter.
Oh, okay.
Because 90% of the time I say, oh, I'll never see that again. And I go, oh, man, I wish I'd saved that. You know how many times that's happened to me? Okay, it's hoarding. It's a hoarding behavior. I admit it. I admit that.
Okay,
but we're not talking about filling my room like I've filled it anyway.
Right.
I'm talking about just making sure I save every way I'd ever want to have something.
Okay, so here's a tip. If you look at your list of all of your files, right, that you know that comes up on Fusion 360, you can see in the corners a little thing that says V, right? So yes. So V1 just means there's one version of it, right? I have some that are like, you know, V10, you know, V14 or whatever. It means you've saved multiple versions of it, right? So look at the ones that are like, you know, V10, V20, and back those up, because those are ones you actually put some time into. If it's V1, if you only made one version of it and it turned out fine,
yes,
you could just redo those if you needed to, right?
Yeah, when you click on that little label, mm-hmm. it gives you the history, and you can go back to those histories. I would not back those up. I would only back up the latest version.
Yeah, I would only back up the latest version, and I would only back up something that has a high version number, because, I mean, I've got a lot of stuff where it's like V1. You know, okay, that means that I made something, it worked fine on the first go-round. Right, and most of these things are really simple. It's like I needed a shim for something or whatever.
You're just bragging now.
No, it's just I make a lot of things that are simple, single-use things.
You're just showing off. You're just bragging. Look how good I am at Fusion 360, everybody. I only do it in one version.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying that that most of the things that I've produced on it are very simple.
Yeah.
Right? I have things where I've got 20 or 30 versions of it, and it's still not right, and I gave up.
That happens. Right? But I've got some things in here. Like, for example, the downward blower vent for the Race 3D N2.
Uh-huh.
You know, that thing is so complicated. It has so many things in its history tree, and right now it's designed perfect.
Uh-huh.
Oh, that thing's gold, and there's no way I'd ever lose that. No way I'd ever want to lose that. To start that from scratch would take days and days to get it just right.
Right, so you better back that up.
Yeah. But you know what? I'm not going to even think about it. I'm just going to create a directory and says, here's all my Fusion 360 files, and just dump them in there, one okay. after another.
Yeah, well, you got the time.
Yeah, I got quite a few of them in there. Oh boy, Whitney, another show written to the hard drive, waiting for encoding, uploading, and commitment on our feed. To all of our very supportive listeners, thank you all out there for your support on Patreon. Thank you for the positive write-up reviews. We really appreciate those a lot. And thanks for listening. We do it for fun. We're doing it just because we enjoy gabbing about 3D printing. And we talk about a lot of other things, too. We just don't have the mics on for those things. Just the things related to 3D printing and making in general. And we hope you enjoy it also. We have a thing of the week this week.
You bet.
Related to Fusion 360, was we just did the segment about them owning your files. They don't own your files, but they could zap them.
Well, if you're not paying, if you're getting a freebie from them, which most of us are.
And you just let it sit right there fallow. But I got messages from Autodesk on the top of the screen of Fusion 360 that says, you're using an Intel-based Mac. Keep in mind, coming March, I think March 7th or sometime in March.
We're turning you off.
We're not supporting your processor anymore.
Uh-huh. Oh, well.
And I was looking at that going, oh boy.
That's the problem with all these cloud things. It's like it used to be, it's like, well, yeah, you upgrade your system. You could install the old software, and it might be a little buggy, and it might, you know,
we're just not going to support it.
But you can still try. Yeah, and 90% of the time, it worked.
Not in the case of a cloud.
Not anymore. No. And I was like, nope, we're not even going to let you try.
No. So it's time for a new computer, and there's no way I'm going to spend the amount of money for a new Mac Pro. This Mac Pro I bought. Used, uh-huh. and I think I paid $1,500 for it, which uh-huh. is, you know, that's a lot these
sure.
days. That's a lot of money, and it ran great for, let's see, how many years? 6 years, five, 6 years, and so it's time for a new machine. And so I went hunting, looking around. I didn't want to go Intel. I've got a Wintel machine under my desk, so I do use a Wintel machine.
Mm-hmm. That's a Windows Intel machine.
Yes.
for those who are not in the know.
Yeah, but I want to stay on the Mac side for Logic Pro and for Fusion 360 and for other specific apps that I use for all my things that I do. So I went hunting, and so the new Mac Mini M4 mm-hmm. is really making a lot of people take a look. I looked at the Mac Mini M4, and from what I'm hearing, bang for buck, the Mac Mini M4 is the machine today. The tests on it are pretty impressive. 10-core performance machine with a 10-core GPU. Mm-hmm. So I took a look at it, and sure enough, you know, remember Thanksgiving, so we just went through Black Friday and Cyber Monday. And for the discounts, with the discounts on Amazon, so I get free shipping, I could get the M4 Mini for, I think it was $600. The M4 Pro for as low as $1,260.
Wow.
Now, with the M4 Pro, I get twice the size SSD card. And a lot of people will say, yeah, but SSD cards are cheap, not the ones that are in the Mini. No, it's a different SSD. It's not a generic off-the-shelf SSD. And the memory is not generic off-the-shelf memory. You can buy replacement memory, and you can upgrade the memory, unlike previous Minis from Apple. But you have to replace it all. So your best bet is probably to maximize what you're going to get. So I went with the M4 Pro. And so now I'm like, well, look, I could get a little stand for it. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. No, this thing is so nice and tiny compared to the trash can Mac Pro that I got, that I'll be able to stick this thing up on the credenza in the back wall behind the screen and hide it completely.
Mounted on the wall.
Uh-huh. So I'm looking at that, and you can pay $80 for that. Or you go to Thingiverse, and sure enough, thing of the week.
Yep.
You can make yourself 3D print your own Mac Mini M4 wall and desktop mount. That comes to us from a Thingiverse user whose handle is Mixin7.
Otherwise known as MF from Germany.
And so I've printed mine out of gray PETG. It could be printed without any supports on its end. And it comes out kind of clean, kind of easy to print.
Yeah,
no big deal.
Nice looking print. Yeah.
And that's what we're going to do. And so if you're thinking about getting yourself a Mac Mini, or if you've got one coming for Christmas, you got to print one of these, because this this takes it. First, you know, in the Mini design, on the desktop, you just kind of wonder why they did this. They put the off-on power switch in the back underneath, and the fan is kind of on the bottom. So if the dust settles on your desk, it gets sucked up right into that fan. So if you really got to use one of these, because now you can access the on-off switch, and the fan intake is up away from where dust collects. So
gotcha.
This probably is an optimal way to go.
Well, I really like the idea of having a bracket where it's attached to something, because the damn thing's so small, I would like lose it on my desk.
Yeah, you probably would.
It's like, you could almost fit that thing in your pocket. In fact, I think I have cargo pants that I could fit one of those in my pocket.
It's pretty amazing for how powerful the thing is. Yep. It's their tests are showing that it's substantially more powerful than the Mac Studio M2. Mm-hmm.
I think you're very, very wise to not plan on doing any upgrades on it, because looking at the size of it, I'm used to doing upgrades on like an AT tower, you know, and it's like, yeah, that's easy, nothing to it. But like these things, it's like upgrading your cell phone by opening it up and changing things out. No, you're not going to do that.
No, probably not. Anyway, if you're interested in checking this out, it's on Thingiverse.com, thing number 682457 from Mixin's, what is it?
Mixin7.
If you've got a tip, a question, or a candidate thing of the week, what are you waiting for? Send us an email.
Send it to info@3dprintingtoday.com. That's THREE, followed by letter D, followed by printingtoday.com.
And we'd like to invite you to join our forum on Google Groups. It's free. There's no ads. And I do I do watch it so that there's no flame wars or spam or nonsense. Just go to Google and type in 3D printing tips and tricks. And when you get there, give them an email. Don't use your regular personal email. Go make a burner email on gmail.com and use it for that. And you can then interact with that Google group through that email as well, instead of using their not so great client that doesn't work that well. Let's see. We do have a show next week.
Show number 554. We're going to start out talking about deep mesh watermarking.
We're going to be annealing HTPLA.
And then asking about tariffs.
Oy, I hate that subject. I guess that's it.
Great. Thanks for listening.